Welcome to another episode of That's So Cincinnati. Jason Williams, Sherry Coolidge, Silent Phil in the ones and twos. I'm happy to be back in the seat. Thank you to executive editor Burl Love for filling in, pinch hitting. He does a great job as our guest host, usually when one of us goes on vacation. And I love the buddy interview. You guys did a fantastic job.
We missed
job.
You, but we did have a lot of fun.
I was wondering if you could go on without me, but the show went on. I'm kidding, Sherry. Our special guest today, speaking of big names, continuing on, Hall of Famer, Pro Football Hall of Famer, Anthony Munoz, going to join us, has a big event for his foundation coming up this week, and ask him about the state of the Bengals and Joe Burrow and mentoring, and looking forward to it.
But I feel like it's going to be a long conversation.
I'm excited. I always enjoy hearing him speak, and does a lot of great work. But you know, just really has taken his platform that he gained 13 seasons with the Bengals and the Pro Football Hall of Fame, the only Bengal in the Pro Football Hall of Fame, and has really done a lot of great work for youth across our region. So I'm excited to talk to him. But first, Sherry, we always like to talk a little politics in this segment.
And, we did talk about Wendell Young last week.
You and Burl did,
about
yes.
The suspension, the possible suspension process and how that was all working, that complicated process. We're not going to do that again, but we are on the heels of the Ohio Supreme Court saying that Wendell should not be suspended. I know you all get your news in actuallycincinnati.com, so you all know that already, but just in case you weren't paying that close attention, like we had a big conversation about it, and now we know Wendell will be finishing out his term.
That's right. And so we shift gears. We stick with obviously local politics. That's what we do. And more, there were huge news last week, and it's been the talk of the political world. And
what are we calling it? Let's give it a name. Endorsement gate, endorsement drama. Like, I don't know. All right, that's harder. We shouldn't give it a name, but it definitely is what's happening behind the scenes.
Yes. As I was blown up on vacation while on South Carolina about the endorsement process
for the Democrats.
Democratic Party. I don't even, where do we even start with that? Because this is I'll give you my take on it.
Okay, let's do it.
It's really inside baseball when you really think about it. I understand that the dominant party and their slate is so powerful. And so there's a big fight over who's on it. But at the end of the day, it's all petty infighting when the endorsement committee came up with their slate. They bring it to the party, the full party vote. And then the big stink one of the big stinks is that Michelle Dillingham, who had been endorsed the previous two council races and had barely missed getting on by a couple hundred votes last time in 2017, was not endorsed. So there was that process. And then also it was raised after the fact that, right, there was a concern about whether they followed the bylaws and how to...
And how public it should be. I always err on the side of public, obviously.
Yes.
But that wouldn't have changed what happened.
Correct.
I mean, they knew another reporter had kind of like snuck into the call. We all were following along with those tweets. And so... You know, we did know what was happening. They knew that it was kind of being broadcast there, and I don't think that would have changed anything. So, yes, I always want things to be more public than they are. But, like, the real thing came down to, should Michelle Dillingham be endorsed? And the question is how important it gets to. How important are these endorsements?
Yeah. And what does it mean? Right.
Cincinnati is ever more blue. Joe Biden won by more than Hillary Clinton did in Hamilton County. So you look at that, then you look at the fact that six of the endorsed Democratic candidates last time made it onto council in 2017. But you look then, right, Michelle Dillingham came in 10th, and the rest of their endorsed slate, I believe, were 12th and 13th or 11th and 12th. Like these, it is a very powerful process. And so they're kind of picking the city council. I'm urging all voters to really carefully consider. We have a very strong, it's a strong charter committee slate. Let's see what the Republicans do. You got to pay attention. In the wake of corruption, every candidate needs to be vetted by every voter of who they want to vote for. And the Inquirer is going to empower everybody with all the information that they need.
Yeah. Well, worth noting that you mentioned corruption and that five of the six Democrats who were elected last time have been embroiled in some kind of at least a texting scandal and or public corruption.
Which I don't think anyone could have predicted, and I would not have predicted, right? If I had been the person going into the voting box, I wouldn't have thought to myself, hey, guess what might happen during this term? In fact, I promise you, I did not think that's what might happen.
Correct.
I mean, I believe one of the most stunned moments I think of my entire reporting career is the moment that I heard that Tamaya Dennard had been arrested. Did I know there was all kind of problems with this council and drama and what was going on? Did I expect a council member to be arrested at that point? No.
Right. Sherry, I do want to ask you this, and I great points on – right, you're right. This is the dominant party. Typically, the slate that the dominant party picks is incredibly important to the voters. And so I think there's a great responsibility by the dominant party to really strongly vet their candidates, their endorsement slate, I think even more so than ever now in the wake of what happened or what's happened in the past year, really a couple years if you throw in the texting scandal. And so that's where it becomes important to the broader electorate. Do you think, and you and I haven't talked about this, so I don't know, I'm just winging this question. Do you think that the Democratic Party will endorse in the mayoral race between Aftab Purival, David Mann? David Mann, by the way, I should point out, is the only council member of those six that we mentioned that were elected last time, Democrats, who has not been embroiled in any kind of a scandal?
You know what? That's a good question. I think there's going to be a lot of pressure to do so. And I would be interested to know what their thinking is, because as much as David Mann is leaning a little right at the moment and kind of aligning with Republicans, seeking those votes, I think they're very similar in, you know, their Democratic ideals. And like, it's a fine line of how you would say where they would fall on issues that would come before this council. You don't see, you know, one person would vote totally different than the other person on a variety of things. You think they would vote the same.
Yeah.
And so I'm interested to see where, if the party wants to weigh in on that.
And to, for some perspective, they did not weigh in 2017. The Hamilton County or the Cincinnati Democratic Committee, which is a wing of the Hamilton County Democratic Party, it's the Cincinnati Democrats, did not endorse in the mayor race between John Cranley and Yvette Simpson. John Cranley sort of went around that and got the Ohio Democratic Party endorsement, and so he was able to say I'm the endorsed candidate. But again, that's a big deal, especially when the dominant party, whoever the dominant party is. You flip that around. You go out to like a place like Claremont County, and you have the same kind of fights, but it's from the Republican side,
right?
Because the Republican slate, the endorsed slate, is so critical to being on that, to getting elected. And you're right, Sherry. I would just, and this is not me preaching. This is just me encouraging and saying, like, you'd really hope that folks would do their research, do their homework, and vote who they think, whether they're charter, Democrat, Republican, a mixture of all three, independent, especially in the wake of what's happened on council, that you would hope that the voters would put elect a council that is going to turn away from this really ugly chapter in city government history.
So here's what I'm looking for next. What we heard out of the endorsement process was these are nine candidates and we feel like they're going to get along with each other, which is a good baseline and important when you look at how things have unfolded in City Hall. But I didn't hear, you know, Greg Landsman would be a good councilman because of this. Jan Michelle Lemon Kearney would be a good councilman because of this. Victoria Parks would be a good councilwoman because of this. Like, I didn't hear, like, some specific, like, why these people, Reggie Harris, Mika Owen, Scotty Johnson, Mark Jeffries, Jeff Kramerting, Philip O'Neill. I didn't hear this is why they would make the best council person of the 17 that they really considered. Instead, what did I hear? Fighting.
Yeah. And that's not a good sign. And that's not a criticism of any one individual on that slate.
But I'm not even talking about the – exactly. I agree with you. But I'm not even talking about the fighting. Like, of course, the endorsement process should be a conversation, and I'm not saying that that was a fight. But the people who weren't endorsed
– yes.
Like, they didn't have a good understanding of why they weren't endorsed, because nobody said, well, these people are the best people because ABC, right? So the people who were not endorsed were left to say, but I've done this for the party, I've done that for the party. I mean, Michelle was endorsed 2 times before. She is an organizer for the Cincinnati Teachers Federation. Like, those, so you just didn't really hear, and that ended up being vetted on social media, I think, because we just didn't get a good handle on why these 9 are the best 9.
And Michelle Dillingham did not get endorsed ultimately because she was very vocal in support of issue 3, which we talked quite a bit about here back in April and in the spring. And the union leaders on the endorsement committee led the charge in, I don't know if it's ironic or coincidental, but you know, she works for the teachers union, which was, I think, the only union that endorsed issue 3, if I'm not correct. But ultimately, the 3 big unions that, you know, City Hall, well, 3 of the biggest.
So politics does play a hand in this.
Big time.
In, like, Democratic politics. And Michelle knew what she was doing when she did it. She understood who was on the committee, and it's not like she was surprised. But, you know, she did say what she believed in, which, you know, later when people – she's still on the ballot. She's still on the ballot. She still has name identification, right? And there might be voters who say she did support issue 3, and so I want to vote for her.
That's right. Still on the ballot, and make your own decision on who you think is best to be on the council, the next council. The council that, by the way, will be back to the first 2-year term council since we went to 4-year terms. So sounds a little confusing.
In 8 years, the first 2-year term, the shorter term council where, you know, whoever becomes the mayor has this, you know, this kind of newbie council coming. Yeah. And then in 2 years, you know, voters get another to have council. Another say.
And I think that's important to point out, too, because in 2 years from right now, there will be another slate that will be endorsed. And so there's more turnover, I think. Well, I don't want to get into all that, like, but we've talked about that on here, and I think we can talk about it more, like the importance of or the impact of going back to 2-year terms. And I think we're going to see – I think we'll sit here
– that's a whole other conversation.
I think we'll sit here a year from now, and we'll see. They'll be, what, 6 months, almost 6 months into their new term.
I mean, I saw all the positives for the 4-year terms, and basically like 2 seconds into 4-year terms, I was like, oh.
No. Anyway.
And yeah, so that is a conversation I think we'll definitely be having when we see kind of how things unfold.
Yeah.
I do have special guest Anthony Munoz on the That's So Cincinnati hotline, so I think we should move over to that.
Let's do it.
All right, special guest time here on the That's So Cincinnati podcast, and very pleased to welcome to the podcast Pro Football Hall of Famer, Bengals legend, and all-around great guy, Anthony Munoz. Anthony, how are you?
Jason, Sharon, I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on. Just, you know, a little busy right now trying to come together with our big weekend for the foundation. But things are great. This rain get the course nice and green for us, and we just want the rain to go by for next Monday. So everything's going good. Yeah, everything's going good.
That's what I want to ask you. What have you been up to these days? I know you saw the foundation, and you obviously do a lot of appearances, and the foundation keeps you busy, but what else is going on?
Yeah, the great thing about it, coming out of COVID into 2021, you know, we're off to a great year with the foundation. Retention of partners, new partners. Of course, we're getting a chance to get back into person with some of the events. So that's pretty exciting. I'm traveling a little more now. Of course, last year, I was, you know, prior to 2020, I was on a plane quite a bit. Last year, I think one time I was on a plane, maybe twice, I think, before everything shut down. So I'm starting to travel a little bit with some events. Of course, my wife and I spend a lot of time with our 9 grandkids. So that's, you know, so that's fun watching games, getting our comfortable chairs and going to, you know, basketball, baseball, football coming up. But, you know, and things are keeping me busy. So especially with the foundation, trying to keep that going. We have, you know, we went through last month, went through a bunch of interviews for scholarship recipients and just helping my staff, not getting in the way of my staff, but just trying to help as we put, you know, our events together and continue to try to impact young people in this great community. But, yeah, it's, and then of course, you know, trying to play a lot of golf, which at times it didn't help. But, of course, this is a month where a lot of golf charity golf tournaments are taking place. Yeah, so I've been trying to get out quite a bit. It's been fun for me the last year and a half. Jim Breach, who was our, you know, of course, all-time leading scorer for the Bengals, a teammate of mine in my entire career, an excellent golfer. We had played golf occasionally. You know, sometimes up until last year, we played quite a bit last year. Now, that's been fun. Hanging out with him, and then this year we're off to a good start with a good number of rounds. So, yeah, so there's a lot of different things that are keeping me busy, which I love.
So your foundation, it seems to me like you work with all ages, because we have heard about your scholarships before, but I have to say, I want to tell my listeners, I, 2 summers ago, spent a week at the West Price Hill Recreation Center to kind of talk about the importance of recreation centers in our community. And that was such a special week to me. But one of the moments of that week is I was with a group of kids and they were like, oh, we all have to go. And they got on a bus and they went down to one of your camps and they were so excited. Right. And then I kind of, you know, and they were chattering and of course I know who you are. And, you know, I kind of just watched them leave. But they're coming back. I happened to still be there. It was late in the afternoon. Most of the kids had gone, and these children came back. They were loaded down with fruit. They were telling me about the importance of fruit and what they did all day, and their little faces were so lit up. It was an absolutely one of the amazing experience takeaways from that, of like what is going on in our community.
Well, first of all, you know, I have to say, you know, Sharon, you mentioned the recreation center. I was a product of the recreation center growing up from the age of about 6. You know, on that was my, you know, my kind of safe place as a kid growing up there in the summertime. I was a baseball player, so I got to play as many baseball games as I could in the day with the Ontario Parks and Recreation Center. That's where I met a great mentor of mine at the age of 6, 7, that would eventually be my high school baseball coach, and we still have a relationship today. But that's great that you mentioned the recreation center. But, you know, with our foundation, you know, we work with kids all the way from elementary school all the way through high school, and we really target all areas. Lower Price Hill is one of our areas where, you know, Padilla Roberts Academy, we have a mentoring program there during the school year once a week, you know, with the kids after school. But then with all our programs, Jason and Sharon, we really try to build some continuity relationships more than just we're there one day a week mentoring them. You know, we try to do other things with them, build those relationships. Through COVID, we continue contact with them virtually, doing a lot of different programs. So it was only about a month or two that we weren't connected with them this whole last year. So that's our mentoring program that we have with elementary kids. And then, of course, kids age out in 5th grade from our mentoring. So we started Unplugged with the middle school kids that we still work with them, you know, really allow them to see there's, you know, there's high school options. There's more than high school options, you know, college and trade school, really work with them. So we're going elementary, middle school. Then we have, you probably talk about the character camps. We have middle school character camps where we, you know, again, we're looking forward to getting back into the overnight character camps. We take them away to camp for 3 days. We load them down with gear and they don't pay a penny. None of the kids that experience our programs pay a penny. So everything I talk about, they're totally free. We have corporate partners that sponsor it. So we have two types of overnight character camps that we hopefully get back to. One of them is pretty diverse in the spring, which we missed out this year. And it's about 150 young men from Northern Kentucky, Cincinnati, Dayton, Middletown. And we call it it's a character camp because we do teach them a little football, but we go through character traits and team building and really the importance of working together, regardless of what you look like or what background you come from, they're working together. And then we have one in the fall, which is 100% Hispanic. That's our Hispanic character camp, the same type of camp. So we have those two camps for middle school young men. And then we have a youth leadership seminar for high schoolers that we usually have close to 100 high school at a one-day event. We bring in motivational leadership speakers. We have breakout sessions during that where we try to talk about things that they're not going to usually talk about, you know, with as teenagers. And we kind of have moderators that are, you know, kind of doing that. And at the end of that day, we challenge them and they put together community service projects. And they're unbelievable projects. We track them. I pick two winners and I give them money for the job they're doing. A lot of those programs are sustainable. They have them over the years. In fact, I share this story. Aiken High School several years ago, these are the students that initiated their community service project. They started a school, brick and mortar started school in Sierra Leone. And it's just amazing that what they're doing, they continue to have kids go through the school. And that's our leadership seminar. And then we have two types of scholarships. We have our straight A scholarship, which is 18 scholarships, one-time scholarship, $2,000 to $5,000. So we have 18 finalists. We pick a male and a female winner. And we call it straight A because it encompasses all A's, academics, athletics, attitude, achievement. But a big component, a big criteria is overcoming adversity. And so we've had that. So we usually have a luncheon at Jeff Ruby's, but again, with COVID, we're taking those 18 students and we're taking them to our dinner this Sunday night. Then we have our scholarship fund. Where we give a $20,000 scholarship, which we break it up into $5,000 a year for 4 years. And in the past, we've had anywhere from 4 to 6 individuals that we present at our dinner. But this year, I was playing golf last year with one of my original board members, and he's still a great friend, play a lot of golf. He said, Anthony, here's an idea. This is your 20th anniversary. We got to give away 20 scholarships. I'm thinking, okay, that's a great thought. You're talking $20,000 scholarships. So I got after it, and we actually got the money to give away 20,000, but we had 16 legitimate resumes. So, but then we got another 4 from NKU. So we're actually giving away 24 scholarships in addition to the 18 at our dinner Sunday night. So those are the 7 programs that we do at the foundation. This is our 20th anniversary. I don't have the exact numbers, but I think it's in the vicinity of 45,000 kids that we've worked with in the 20 years, maybe well over $15 million we've raised. And the exciting thing for me, guys, is, you know, I started this foundation 8 years after I retired because I wanted to be totally engaged. I wanted to know what was going on. And I understand why you're playing. You have the name. You have the leverage. But to be an NFL football player, to be a husband, to be a father, I didn't have the time to be engaged in the foundation. So I waited until our kids were about sophomores in college, close to getting out of college. So I'm totally engaged for 20 years. I'm here. I run all the board meetings. And like I said earlier, I was jokingly, but I try to stay out of the way of my staff and volunteers and just kind of give some input here and there. But we've been consistently over the years, 89 to 91% of the dollar going to the kids. And that's one thing that I really, really, really look at accomplishing with the foundation. You know, our staff, we're a lean staff, only 3 staff full time. We usually have 4 to 8 local college interns. That's one thing we started from the beginning. They come in and they intern with us and they get to learn what we're doing because we're so lean staffed that they get a chance to really work and learn. I got 16 unbelievable board members and not to mention the great corporate and private donors in this great community that make this happen.
You know what? I do want to talk about your football career because that's the part. Uh-huh. I've been following your philanthropy. Right, we write about that now and we are hearing what you're doing, although I did not know you were giving away 24 college scholarships. That is just, it's stunning to me. It's so impressive. When you say, you said in passing, you're like, I stepped it up. Oh, did you? Like, it sounded like you had to raise a lot more money to get that done. But can you tell us about your football career? I mean, it just, when I was reading about just your statistics, it's just, wow.
Well, you know, a lot of people, and I'm sure, you know, we'll talk about the NFL career, but that's what people have a tendency to focus on is the body of work, the 13 years with the Bengals, the Pro Bowls, the Lineman of the Year, the Hall of Fame. But I always like to share the journey because I think that's what really it speaks to young people. And that's what really at my age gives me that connection with young people is that, you know, being raised in a single parent home, my mom raised five of us. And quite frankly, guys, baseball, I was going to be a Major League Baseball player. That was my first love at the age of six. I have two older brothers. I started playing competitively like at 6, 7 years old. I saw that God had blessed me with baseball talent. So that's what I wanted to do. And so at the age of seven, I started playing baseball. I talked about parks and recreation. So I started playing baseball with that dream. Was a product of flag football. I was a third baseman pitcher. The strength of my baseball game was my arm. I had a very strong arm. So I played quarterback from eight years old to eighth grade. So you got to imagine, I'm a quarterback, third baseman pitcher. So never put the pads on until I'm going into high school, my freshman year, and I decided, okay, all my buddies I've gone to junior high with played some Pop Warner. They were playing Pop Warner. I didn't. So I'm going to play tackle football with them. So first time I put the pads on as a freshman, 14 years old in high school, looked at them to make sure I was putting the pads on right, and I was going to be a quarterback. I was going to be a quarterback with my buddies at, you know, about 6'2", 230 coming in as a freshman. So I run over to, you know, they split us up at the first practice as a freshman. And I run over to the quarterback coach where the quarterbacks were, and the coach looks at me and says, "What are you doing here?" I said, "I'm going to be your quarterback." And he said, looks at me, kind of up at me because I was a little bigger than him. And he goes, "Well, you're not a quarterback." I said, "Well, you see all those fast wide receivers? I've been throwing to those guys for years, you know, growing up as a kid, flag football and junior high." And I said, "No, you got to go in and see Henry." And Henry was our equipment manager. And so he says, "You have to change your face mask," because I had that quarterback two-bar face mask. And so I ran in, a little disappointed. Henry put on a cage face mask, the full cage. I came out that first day, and I was a lineman, put my hand down in a three-point stand. I wasn't really excited about it because I wanted to be a quarterback. And so second day of practice, I'm like, this is fun. I'm like the biggest kid on the team, and I'm having to block these guys that are, you know, a lot smaller than me. This is fun. So I guess this coach knew what he was doing. By my junior year, I was All-State. Offense and defense in football, offensive lineman, defensive lineman, started to get all these letters from colleges to go to school and play football. But at the same time, I was much better in baseball. I was actually All-State in baseball my sophomore year. So I was 3 years All-State in baseball, two in football. But, you know, SC was like, it was a no-brainer for me. You know, I grew up watching the Trojans and wanted to go there, and they recruited me to come to school and play football so I could play baseball. So after 4 years of high school playing three sports, I went to USC and, again, went there with all these plans. I mean, you know, when I was going to USC, man, they were winning national championships, winning Rose Bowls, Heisman Trophy winners, All-Americans, number one draft picks in the NFL, and I wanted some of that. But I got there in 4 years at USC with the plan of doing all that. I played one healthy season. I had three knee operations in 4 years at USC. My freshman year, I got hurt. My junior year, I got hurt. Sophomore year, I played healthy. My senior year, last hurrah, I got hurt. Not only had my third knee operation, but it was in the first game of the season, missed the entire season. So my football career was really in question. All the experts, all the pundits said, you know, it's over with, Anthony. You got to, you know, do something else. Football's over with. But I got hurt in that first game, and we played in two Rose Bowls, and I'd yet to play in one. I'd missed both of them, you know, both UCLA games and Notre Dame games. And so I rehabilitated. My schedule was I'd go to class, go to see the trainers, rehab, lift weights, and then go home and do homework. And I was married at that time. Dee Dee and I got married my sophomore year. So we were going through that last year with uncertainty together. Well, I rehabilitated and I got healthy, and I talked my coach into letting me practice for the Rose Bowl. We were going to our third Rose Bowl in 4 years. And like I said, I hadn't played in the first two, and I finally convinced them that I was healthy. The doctor gave me the okay. My leg was strong. I had two on my right, and my senior year, it was my left leg. And by this time, my left leg was stronger than my right. That's how hard I was working at getting it ready. Made every practice, played the entire Rose Bowl game. That was the only game I played my senior year. And again, all the experts are saying, oh, that's a nice finish to a college career. You missed a lot of games. You got to play in the Rose Bowl. You guys won the Rose Bowl. now you have to look at something. Well, I said, no, I'm going to continue to bust my rear end, get ready, and just maybe a team will take a chance on me. They're saying you won't get drafted, maybe a free agent. And I said, it only takes one team to give me a chance to go to an NFL camp and see if I can compete. And, you know,
April 29th, I feel like you're really convincing. I'm just going to put that out there.
well, you know, I had to convince my coach, and I did. And there was one other, Sharon, you mentioned convincing. There's one other act that I had to do to convince somebody. One team came out to L.A. to work me out after that Rose Bowl, and they happened to have the third pick in the draft. And that was the Cincinnati Bengals. Forrest Gregg was their new head coach, Hall of Fame tackle for the great Green Bay Packers. And I guess that workout worked because, you know, a couple months later, they drafted me as the number one pick, the third pick in the entire draft. Nobody thought that would ever happen. I'm sure there was a lot of Bengals fans that were scratching their heads saying, what are these people doing? Drafting a guy that's only played one healthy season in 4 years. And that leads to, you know, the NFL career, 13 years with the Bengals, 11 Pro Bowls. I didn't miss a game until my 11th year because of a dislocated elbow. And I'm very thankful to Paul Brown and the Brown family and the city of Cincinnati because they gave me an opportunity. They embraced Dee Dee and I as a young married couple. And here we are 41 years later, still living in Cincinnati after being retired for 28 years and loving this community. And this is home now. We had a chance to go back to L.A. a week after my last game in Cincinnati, but we decided to stay here and make Cincinnati home. So that's kind of and I love sharing that journey because really that's what makes who you are. And that's what I share with young people. Don't ever forget where you come from. Single parent. We never had a car. We didn't have a whole lot of money. Never knew my dad. He was in and out of prison. He's dead, you know. And then you get a chance to go to college and then that doesn't work out. You get your education paid for. So that was great. And then you never know if you're going to, you know, achieve a dream. Baseball had kind of gone away and football was my dream now. And then all the injuries, but then, you know, the Bengals give me that shot to get to an NFL camp. And wham, I get a chance now to wear the gold jacket and that big ring and have a bust up in camp. So I'm very, so you can imagine how grateful and thankful I am.
Anthony, everything you just shared there, and you've talked so much about it. I remember, I used to work at City Gospel Mission and fundraising.
Oh, yeah.
I've been to your house, and I know you've done it. You've been great for that organization as well as many, many other organizations. But you've talked so much about mentoring and the importance. And I got to share this with you. This just happened about 3 weeks ago where a kid that I used to work with, mentor, my now brother-in-law, he's a friend at the time. We work with a group of kids from Lower Price Hill, and this kid this was early 2001, 2002. And it was through City Cure at the time. And this kid was just shot and killed in Roselawn a few weeks ago. And I've been, my brother-in-law and I were really, we were talking about this last week. And, you know, we were both kind of like, you know, the struggles we've kind of been wrestling with. And that I moved to Minnesota for a job and he moved to be a missionary in Bosnia, and at the time, right at a really crucial time for these guys. And I'm not saying like save the world thing, but these guys are coming on to middle school at about that time. And Sherry talked about that. You just talked about it. Your organization is focused on kids and even into young adults of all these various ages and backgrounds. How important is that relationship? You know, you raise a lot of money, but all the money doesn't mean anything without those mentoring relationships, does it?
It really doesn't. And let me just share that. I talked about Parks and Recreation, Sharon, that you're involved with. And so I met in 1965, I'd have been 7 years old, I met a guy named Jim Seaman. He was the new head of Parks and Recreation in Ontario. And he was the guy that we would meet at 7 a.m. during the summer. And we would open up a big shed and throw the bases out and play baseball. And quickly, I found out Jim Seaman is now the new varsity baseball coach at Chaffee High School that I would attend when I get high school age. So, man, that was even more important because now I had to prove as a seven-year-old that when I get to high school, I'm going to be your starting third baseman. Well, he became a mentor. So he was a great baseball. He had pitched on the 61 USC National Championship team. So he was a man of character, I mean, but he was a tough man. You did it the right way with character and integrity. So I had a chance to have that experience through Parks and Recreation. Then I started at third base for him for 3 years in high school. He was that father role model for me and a lot of other young men that we didn't have. Sure, I had two older brothers, but I didn't never had a dad. So Jim Seaman would, man, like I said, we were going to do it right. We were going to, but we were going to bust our tails. And if you didn't obey the rules and regulate, you were going to sit. It didn't matter if you were the starting third baseman, all state, or the backup first baseman. If you broke a rule, you were going to pay the consequences. And that's what he taught us. Now, guys, fast forward. We're, what, 56 years into this relationship? I'll be 63 in August. I have an award. We're having our dinner Sunday night, and I'm so sad that Jim won't be able to come out. And we lost his wife, Cheryl, last year, about a year ago. They were married 57 years. We give out the Jim Seaman Impact Award, and this year it'll be called the Jim and Cheryl Seaman Impact Award because of the impact he had on young men like myself and guys he coached and he taught during high school and even past high school. We give that award to people here in Cincinnati, someone here in Cincinnati that does the same thing that Jim did with us growing up. And so we talk about mentoring. I mean, it wasn't an official mentoring program, but he got it. He understood what mentoring was as a coach. And that's what really, you know, people talk about paying it forward. I talk about now as I get older, I talk about honoring those that poured into our lives. My mom that we lost 5 years ago, my coaches, my teachers. I remember a home ec teacher, Mrs. Madeline Falcon, who every time I went back to high school, I'd see her. She was my home. I mean, it's home ec. I mean, you got this 300-pound football player taking a home ec class because we learned how to cook at home.
Did you learn how to sew, too?
I learned how to sew, learned how to iron. I can iron patches. I can sew. I can wash clothes. We learned. We had to learn all that. So I knew that was an easy A, taking a cooking class, because I learned how to cook. And we had to survive because mom was working 2-3 jobs. But that's what mentoring is all about. It's just pouring into, you know, your people's lives. And that's what we love to do. So not only, like you mentioned, Jason, not only do we have programs, but we build relationships. We've had scholarship kids that we give scholarships come in and work here in the office and have them do their homework because all the adversity they're going through at home, now they're in college all by themselves. They're usually, you know, taking care of a sibling, and they struggle with that. I mean, they're like 4-6 GPAs or all this, but they're now alone. So we have them come in here, our staff kind of mentors, we mentor them as they're going through college and say, hey, why don't you come in, do your homework here, and just do some work for us here. And they do that. So, and, you know, we try to take our scholarship kids to a Reds game and get them connected with board members and corporate people in the community. And so we're always trying to build relationships and mentor them. And, you know, we have one young lady who said, I want to graduate high school. I'm going to play music and make money because we need money. Well, we took her to NKU on a visit as a junior high student. And she saw that there was a person of color like herself, Hispanic, that was majoring in music in college. And she's like, wow, I can go to college and study music and even do better. And so now her dream is to go to college and, you know, major in music. So those are the type of things that we love, Jason, and mentoring. And you mentioned City Gospel, City Cure. Our very first Jim Seaman Impact Award, and this is going back, I don't think you're old enough, but the original guy that I met with City Cure, the executive director, was a guy named Ben Huffine. And we lost Ben at a very early age. He had a massive heart. But him and his wife were living downtown with like 11 kids running City Cure. Wow. And I mean, it's, you talk about someone that is giving their lives to the mission field, to other people. Those are people that really have an impact on people. So, yeah, there's a lot of people in my life, you know, my wife, we've been married 43 years. And I mean, it's strange, but she's taught me a lot. I mean, she's been really the glue to the family, and she's been I've learned a lot from her, and it goes both ways, but man, she's been so supportive and encouraging through this 20 years with the foundation, through my, you know, last 2.5 years of college, my 13 years in the NFL, because we've gone through it all. We basically have grown up together. I was 19 when we got married. You know, we just celebrated 43 years of marriage, so we've gone through it. So she's been a rock, you know, and I tell people, I thought my sophomore year in college, that was going to be the most important decision I made in my life. I can say it's been the second most important decision, because later that year, after we got married, that's the year that my faith journey started. That's when I gave my life to Jesus. That's the most important. decision I made in my life. And then Didi's the second. And that's been so exciting to have that faith in our family. And not perfect, no. Bumps and, you know, through the road, yep. But we've worked through it. We know where to go when times are tough. So, again, you know, our faith has meant everything to us. And that's what really motivates me and energizes me to give back to these young people, because we know going through a lot of adversity, a lot of things at home. But, man, a lot of these kids are so talented. They have so many tremendous gifts. They just need some encouragement, maybe need a little assistance. Just someone to say, hey, we love you. Man, you can do this. And that's what, you know, people said to me. We didn't have a whole lot, but they say, you got some ability. You can do this. And even through adversity, you can do this. They supported me. And that's what we like to do with the young people in this great community.
Okay, so I'm going to pivot this because we only have so much time. You're very busy. Right, we feel very lucky to have you. So we're going to ask you some fun questions, and there is no way we are getting off this podcast without asking you about the Joe Burrow era of the Bengals. So, Jason, you want to ask some fun questions first? I know you had a list.
Well, there's a couple things. I don't know if we're going to be able to get to it today. We'll have you back sometime.
That'd be great.
I love it's you know, your kids, and you have 9 grandkids now. But I want to ask you. I did want to ask you a couple football things.
Yeah, definitely.
This is, I guess, it's maybe a twofold question. One is the Bengals Ring of Honor, and two is the. You're the only Cincinnati Bengal in 50-plus years of the organization to be in the National Football Hall of Fame. So I'll ask you that one.
Are there other
Bengals players that deserve to be in there? And I know there's been a lot of talk of Ken Riley and Ken Anderson, and Willie Anderson's coming up here. Where are you at on that? And if you do want other Bengals players in there, do you go to bat for?
You cannot have 53 years of an organization, 2 Super Bowls, several playoff appearances, and not have, I mean, I think there's more than a handful of guys that deserve to be in the Hall of Fame. And I'm an advocate for a lot of guys. You know, they're selectors. They usually call out a lot of us when there's a class, you know, being ready to be selected. They'll call us. What do you think about this guy? And Sharon, you mentioned pivot. I always pivot when I'm talking to senior selectors. I pivot and say, well, let's talk about Kenny Anderson. And I dominate the conversation because I'm the biggest. I don't know if I'm the biggest, but I'm one of the biggest advocates for Kenny Anderson. He should be in the Hall of Fame. It's a travesty that he's not. And so Kenny Anderson, Kenny Riley, you know, you mentioned Willie Anderson. I'm talking, Lamar Parrish, Isaac Curtis. There is a guard that I played with for 10 years here that left and played on another team that I think is so underrated, except for those that know the game. And Hall of Fame guards I've talked to say he's one of the best offensive guards that's ever played the game. That's Max Montoya. You know, there's another guy that's worthy of being in the Hall. I mean, look at Boomer Esiason's career, 16 years, MVP, Super Bowl. So I can go on and on. So, yes, it's a travesty that I'm the only. And, yeah, I want other guys because they have these banners in the pro shop at the Hall of Fame, and they're team banners, and they have all the guys from a certain team on there that are in the Hall of Fame. And I finally found one. I think my wife had it made. It has a Bengal helmet. It has my number on it. And that's it. You got the Raiders who have, 30 guys, the Bears, the Packers. There's a lot of guys that I think are worthy that have had Hall of Fame careers that should be in the Hall of Fame. And I am still confused and really upset. I don't understand why. I don't understand, just guys I played with and then guys before me and guys after me, You mentioned, Willie Anderson, Kenny Riley. Kenny Riley and Kenny Anderson, I mean, should have been in. You have the top 8 defensive backs, the top 8 interceptors of all time, and there's just one that's not, and he's, I think, number 5, and he's not in, Kenny Riley. He's number 5, I think, in all-time interceptions, and he's not in, And this is, I mean, so I don't know. I will continue to be an advocate and as long as I can, and hopefully and they start listening and get guys in there that deserve to be in.
That was a great list, and we have to advocate for ourselves in Cincinnati, right, to remind people how great we are all the time.
Yes, exactly. Great city. I tell you what, the Natty.
Tell us what you're thinking kind of about this new era of the Bengals. Do you talk to Joe Burrow? Is this real? All the hype that we're hearing, like, this is it for us. We are – we're, you know, marching into championship territory again. What are you thinking?
So, well, first of all, it's crazy because, you know, Joe was a rookie last year. We're going through the pandemic last year. No preseason games last year. Nobody allowed to go. So I was not down there one time. So usually I have a chance to do preseason games, travel with the team, meet all the new guys. Zach usually has me talk to the team, but none of that happened. So I've never met Joe Burrow. Impressed with Joe Burrow, over the top impressed with Joe Burrow. I watched him just about every game his senior year at LSU. Ed Orgeron, I'm a big fan of Ed, the head coach at LSU. He was a longtime coach at USC, still upset that they didn't keep him as the head coach at USC out west, but followed him closely, still do at LSU. So I watched just about every game. Very impressed with Joe Burrow. But then the fact, after we drafted him, I'm thinking, this is great. Mentally, physically, last year as a rookie, the guy was phenomenal. I'm sad to see that he got hurt, but I'm sure he'll be stronger than ever this year because of his work ethic and technology. So I'm excited about the Joe Burrow era. I'm excited about you know, what they're doing, the talent they have. If you look at the roster, it's become Zach Taylor's roster. I mean, very few guys that are here that when he got here, but I think they're loaded with talent. I think they made some coaching moves this year that I'm excited about. You know, a lot of people were on the Sewell Panay train, the tackle from Oregon. We took Jamar Chase, wide receiver from LSU. That's great. I mean, great playmaker. Of course, you know, is not just because of former offensive lineman. I wanted to see Panay, but, you know, I felt, you know, Burrow needed some protection. But the one thing I'm excited about, and it's the first thing I'll say, is that Frank Pollock is back. If people don't know who Frank Pollock is, look it up. He's the new offensive line coach. He was here 3 years ago. He left. They brought him back. Great technician, great teacher of technique. He fits in your face. He's going to give you that intensity that offensive line likes. So I really expect and look forward to the young guys developing under Frank Pollock, Jonah Williams, Michael Jackson. I mean, you know, and then, of course, getting Riley Reiff from the Vikings. And some of the guys that have been here, I really see them progressing with Frank Pollock. But I'm excited. You know, we still have to go out and win games. We haven't won a lot of games. So that's still – but I really like what's happening with this football team, the talent they have, the draft they had, the draft they've had the last couple of years. So, but the Joe Burrow era, I love Joe. I really believe this. And I loved Andy Dalton, what he did. The fact of where this team was and what we needed to have accomplished, getting the Ohio kid and a guy that is a phenomenal, I think he's phenomenally mentally as well as physically. I'm excited about what's going on here with the Bengals.
All right. Well, thank you so much for coming on. It was wonderful to get to know you. And we're going to let everyone know about all of your philanthropic work. Tell us the exact name of the foundation and where we can find it online.
Yeah. Yes, yeah, the Anthony Munoz Foundation. You could go to munozfoundation.org and you can see the programs we have and how people get involved, from volunteering to giving to, you know, anyway. So we take all suggestions and all donations, and we look for volunteers to help us with everything we're doing. So munozfoundation.org, the Anthony Munoz Foundation. And Sharon, thank you very much for this time. And maybe another time, Jason, yourself and I can do it again. We can talk again.
All right, we do have repeat guests. I feel like you're going to be one of them. Thanks so much.
All right. Have a great day. Thank you.
All right. I mean, honestly, we were definitely not going to let him off the phone without telling us what he thinks about the Cincinnati Bengals. As honestly, it's June and that season does seem to be gearing up. We're writing about that all the time now. And you know what? He did make a mention. You know what else kind of, it's what season it is? Intern season. He talked about the importance of interns and working with them and mentoring in general. We have two helpers today, Landon and Zane, our interns here, helping out. And so it's always fun to have like the interns, you know,
two of around. Our photojournalist interns. Yeah.
Yes.
I just met him yesterday. Landon from the University of North Carolina, Zane from Western Kentucky University.
So yes, a little bit of help today behind the scenes.
Love it. Love it. Burrow Love and our previous editor, Peter Batia, really have placed a huge importance on our internship program. And it's exciting to walk in our newsroom and see, you know, future journalists in action. Well, they're journalists now. They're not future. They're now. And yes. So it's exciting. And to see a diverse group of our interns and from, you know, all different schools. And so it's great to, I just love the energy of interns. And
reminds you of your youth. Is that right?
I wasn't going to go there, but my time in fall of what?
No, don't.
97 at the Birmingham News in Alabama when they called me a Yankee.
Oh, my. Anyway,
I'm like, I'm from Appalachian, Ohio, man. I'm no Yankee. Anyway.
So, all right, you're fresh off vacation.
And I think that provides us with our That's So Cincinnati moment of the week.
Do tell.
It has to do with Ohio and Cincinnati's love of going to Hilton Head. And so we are at Hilton Head last week, and my parents moved down to that area, Beaufort County, Bluffton, which is right off of the island. They live in a Sun City. Hilton Head is their retirement community. And so, but we've been going down for 11 years, and you go down there, and I know there's a lot of our listeners who can relate to this because you go down there yourselves, is that every other car is from Ohio, and pretty much every other car beyond that is from Hamilton County. And so there's a guy who sings kid songs, Greg Russell, and he's been doing it for 44 years. This is the start of his 44th summer, and he does it out in Harbortown by the lighthouse, the red and white lighthouse. And it's out under a big 300-year-old tree, and it's what you do if you're a kid going to Hilton Head. And so we go see Greg Russell, and it's packed. And our kids, all the kids get to sit up on this deck around him, and then all the parents sit on these like little benches. And, it, you know, there, it's 500-600 people. And Greg Russell does a trivia thing of the Hilton Head Light, the Harbortown Lighthouse. And of all the hundreds of kids there, he calls my son, Reed. And Reed goes up, and he's facing a gal from Athens, Alabama. And Reed, he's, "Oh, Reed, you know, where are you from?" "Cincinnati, Ohio." And half the crowd goes nuts. And Greg Russell says, he's like, "You know, I've never been able to understand it, but there are more people who come here from Ohio than anywhere else in the world." And the reception that Reed got just by saying he's from Cincinnati, Ohio, I thought was like, that's got to be a So Cincinnati moment of the week.
I mean, absolutely. So we went to Hilton Head a couple years ago for, you know, a week. I saw two different people I know from here. Yeah. I'm like walking down the street and someone's like, "Hey, Sherry." And I'm like, "Well, hi."
It's
like,
happened to me before too, yes.
People that I didn't know were down there like at that moment. And like, that is just what it is there.
Yes. Or you also run into someone and you start talking to them and you know someone mutually.
Totally.
Yes. It's not a very big place.
How'd Reed fare in the trivia contest?
Not real well. The questions were, how many steps are in the Harbortown Lighthouse? He said like 1,043, which is like, dude, it's not. And it's like 170 or something.
Yeah, that's, my math skills, right? Not that great. I might have guessed that.
Though he showed his knowledge of the lighthouse when they said, "So what's at the top of the lighthouse?" He says, "A gift shop and a light." And you would only know that there's a gift shop up there if you've been up it. So, because the other gal said light. Well, ultimately, Greg Russell says, "Well, technically there's a lightning rod on the top. So that's what's at the top of the lighthouse." But I was pretty proud of Reed by saying like gift shop.
I know. He is Bethany's son. Jason's wife. Jack would have said the same thing probably because we would have been in there and had bought something.
Yes. Anyway.
All right, well, that is perfect. I'm so glad you're back, though.
Glad to be back. Thanks again to you and Burl, and thanks again to Anthony Munoz, Buddy LaRosa. Stick with us because we got a huge guest next week. We're continuing on the summer of big-name guests.
Now the pressure is on after this kind of, like, trio.
So I'm excited about this one. I'm excited about all of them, but I'm particularly excited about our next guest. I'll give you a hint. Another major figure from the sports world. So leave it at that. And we'll catch you next week.